Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Ewan Kerr. This weekend's events in Charlottesville, Virginia, have added more fuel to the fire in the national conversation on racism, racial privilege, and the nation's history of slavery and racial discrimination. One important chapter in this history opened in August 2014 when a white police officer fatally shot an African-American, Michael Brown Jr. The shooting set off a series of protests and demonstrations in Ferguson, Missouri, widely covered in the press.
Police are calling for calm this morning after a night of looting and fires.
This all started when it was supposed to be a very peaceful vigil tonight for Michael Brown turned into this.
Teams of thieves using the protest as an excuse to steal jeans, shoes, and expensive tire rims.
The Quick Trip was broken into, the glass was busted out.
Details surrounding the shooting that sparked this fire in great debate.
At Ground Zero, police painted over threatening graffiti.
And as sundown approaches, officials are fearful of another night of looting and violence.
However, protesters saw what was happening in an entirely different way.
The question that solidifies violence to me, were there any people harmed? Did any people die? Like, that qualifies violence. A building is a building. That's a revolutionary act. That's strategic.
They don't tell you the fact that the police showed up to a peaceful candlelight vigil of just a bunch of people holding up candles because they hurt, and boxed them in and forced them onto a Quick Trip lot. They put property over people and say, we got a problem in St. Louis because a Quick Trip burned down. But ain't no alchemist, no doctor, no wizard on this planet can bring back Mike Brown Jr.
This is audio from a new documentary opening nationally this weekend called Whose Streets? New York-based filmmaker Sabah Falayan went to Ferguson in September 2014 to document the communities behind the dramatic scenes playing out on the news. She and her crew gathered new material, but Whose Streets also makes extensive use of media shot by protesters and activists during the protests. She also followed how the activist community organized and kept working in the weeks and months that followed Michael Brown Jr.'s death. Folayan was in Minnesota to show the film at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival, and she came into the NPR studios to talk about the film and what motivated her to make it. How quickly did you decide to get down to Ferguson? How quickly did you decide that this was really a big story that you had to?
Immediately when it happened, I knew that I needed to go. That summer seemed like everywhere in the world there were so many crazy things going on, and I remember seeing the images that were coming out of Gaza, and that really kind of just fired me up as far as wanting to be a part of standing up for and reporting on what was happening to vulnerable people, because I saw such a discrepancy between what I would see on Democracy Now! And Al Jazeera and what I would see, you know, here on NPR and what I would see on the mainstream media. And it just struck me as being so unfair. And I knew that one thing I could do was to try to reinterpret what was going on. I had been posting on social media a lot that whole summer leading up to this. And people were really resonating with the things that I was saying. I was just commenting on different articles and issues of the moment. People would come to me in person and, you know, email me and tell me that they appreciated what I was doing. And I sort of felt like I wasn't really doing anything but kind of ranting on social media. So when this happened, it felt like I needed to go and you know, just pursue this energy and this feeling and try to be part of changing the narrative somehow.
We all saw the images that were coming out of that time there, but clearly that's very mediated. What was it like when you arrived and saw what was going on and experienced what was happening in the streets?
I mean, I was amazed because there was so much love and care. This community had been created. I got there about a month after it initially happened. And by the time I got there, you know, there were all these different strategies. People had started to form different affinity groups and There was a woman, Mama Cat, who would come out every day and cook and make sure people have food and water so they could keep protesting. There were street medics, and there were legal, you know, bail fund and legal defenders, observers, and people had different roles. You could see this ecosystem starting to emerge, and people had different views and different tactics, but a lot of people really cared about each other, and that was the first thing that I saw that wasn't getting reported in the way that this whole situation was being construed. There was no sense that the people who were engaging in protests had any identity outside of being anti-police, quote-unquote. So just the humanity of everyone is what I expected to find. And, you know, when I found it, it was even more of a sophisticated kind of, you know, really analytical and smart and caring group of people than I could have imagined.
Obviously, shootings like this, it's not new, but what happened in Ferguson was different, very different. What was it, do you think, that caused this explosion? Well, we know what caused the explosion, but caused it to become the...
I think it's the people of St. Louis. I think that St. Louis is a really, really special place. It occupies a really special place in our country's history. It was the first state to leave the Union, the last one to return. You have the Missouri Compromise over slavery. You have the Dred Scott decision. All of these historical points have happened in St. Louis, and I think it just makes for a very particular environment. And I think it's that combination of history of this very intense redlining and segregation. All of these things have happened. When Mike Brown's body lay on the ground, I think every minute that passed when his mother wasn't able to go and you know, be with her son, and when they treated people the way that they did there in that neighborhood, I think every minute that passed just intensified the memory of all of that stuff that was building up. And it was just people who had had enough. And they came out just to grieve and to really be together and to make a statement. And then they were met with such intense force that, you know, there were new affronts every time they would come out to just try to express how they felt about this. And I think a lot of times, you know, when the focus is on what happens to buildings and property, people forget what the directionality of that violence is and who really picked the fight and who really, you know, started it. And there's a history in this country of political violence or political property destruction happening in protest. And it was studied in the 60s. There was a report commissioned by the government, and they found that it's usually the police who are the ones who initiate violence in those situations. And that was another big surprising thing that I found, is that the police were truly the ones who were provoking people. They were truly the ones who were escalating things. They were truly the ones who were taking the energy from something that was, yes, meant to be disruptive, meant to stop the flow of business as usual, meant to make it difficult for the status quo to carry on, but certainly not inherently harmful or destructive until people came to exercise their First Amendment rights and were gassed and were chased and were shot at. All these different things that just really raise the stakes for everyone.
My guest today is Sabah Folayan. She is the director of the documentary film Whose Streets, which opens nationally this week. It's about the protests and the community in and around Ferguson, Missouri, following the death of Michael Brown Jr. It also became a media war, and there was the portrayal that was going out in the quote-unquote mainstream media, but then there was the media that was being created by the people involved in the protest through social media. And I remember sitting, watching things being broadcast live from people's phones and from their cameras and whatever, and just showing it as it was spinning out. And that must have been quite, I mean, in a way that became it was a distraction in a way, but it became part of the whole issue, this who gets to tell the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely not a distraction, because the media war and the information war is absolutely the front line of the battle that we're in, all of us, in terms of politics, in terms of Trump, this idea of fake news, that is the before the decisions get made and the actions get taken, there are thoughts and ideas, and this is how they're communicated. So I absolutely think that it was critical for citizens to come out into the streets and take on the role of journalists and fill that gap that journalists were not filling as far as presenting information and allowing people to make up their own minds. I think that you see so much punditry and you see so much, you know, they just loop the most sensational video and give these, you know, really unfounded and non-expert opinions about it. And this is how people are shaping their political views. This is how people are making their decisions. It's the information people are using to move through the world. I can't tell you how many times I've had to have, you know, conversations with white people who think that they're liberal, who are simply repeating Bill O'Reilly's talking points about black people. And so, you know, I think the media war is absolutely central to the conversation. Immediately after Mike Brown was killed, video was released that tried to incriminate him, though it had nothing to do with the interaction between he and Darren Wilson. So it just goes to show you it's very important how a story is portrayed, who gets to be the good guy, who gets to be the bad guy. That's what determines what's allowed to happen in the physical world. And so, again, I just commend everyone who took it upon themselves to tell that story, to live stream it, to bring some transparency to the situation. I think in the world we're in now, that's the kind of energy that's required is for us to start taking things upon ourselves and you know, getting engaged without waiting for permission.
I think your point is well taken. I suppose what I mean, when I use the word distraction, the fact is that someone was killed by the police. And I say this as someone who grew up in a country where, well, they carry them now, but they didn't carry guns. The cops didn't carry guns when I was growing up. And so I still get really freaked out whenever I see a police officer carrying. I sometimes personally worry that we get involved in discussions, very valid discussions about mediation, but there's still this problem. There are people getting killed, you know, by the state.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, I mean, no, I definitely, your point is well taken. I just think that what I'm trying to get at is the media is like very much directly related to the killing in the sense that, you know, you look back and think about that really terribly iconic American photograph of a lynching and you just see people smiling. And Black Death has always been a form of entertainment. You know, there's been some interconnection, I think, from the foundation of this country between kind of surveillance and the mediated experience and the actual physical experience to the black body. You'd think about the war on drugs, the way that we're even able to be killed in the streets, where this fear response comes from, has everything to do with the media and the portrayal of who black people are. And it started way before we had TV. So I think that, you know, I do hear what you're saying as far as it when we talk about the media, it doesn't seem like we're talking about the actual shooting, whether or not that's okay. But I guess my argument is that those things are intertwined with each other. It's not just that Mike Brown was killed. It's that he was killed in broad daylight and left for his body to be watched and seen and, you know, and demeaned in a certain way. That, I think, is what makes it because the killings are happening every day. All of the time. And I think that, you know, police, you can never be inside someone's head. You can never know what they're really thinking. But if we are to take the fear response that they give at face value, then we have to realize that they're not actually interacting with these people as human beings. They're acting with this imagined form of a black person. They're shooting this boogeyman that they've created in their minds, and that comes directly from the media representation. So I think it's always extremely relevant to center that when we're talking about police shootings or any other kinds of shootings of black people.
Please don't shoot me dead. I got my hands on my head. Please don't shoot me dead. I got my hands on my head. Please don't shoot me dead. I got my hands on my head. Please don't shoot me dead. I got my
This is sound from the new documentary film, Whose Streets? You're listening to NPR News. I'm Ewan Kerr, and this is my conversation with the film's director, Sabah Folayan. The documentary tells the story of the 2014 protests in Ferguson, Missouri, following the death of Michael Brown Jr., and the longer-term organizing that happened in the wake of that incident. Folayan and her crew stuck around after the network TV trucks left and kept documenting what was happening in the community. I asked her, given the suspicion of the mainstream media in Ferguson, whether that made things difficult for her to work.
Yeah, there was definitely a certain level of suspicion because a lot of people had found themselves, you know, would give an interview to a major network and then see it on television in a context that made them look bad or made them feel misconstrued, or simply turn on the news and see events being reported that looked totally different from what they had just experienced. So there was a deep mistrust that developed. It wasn't there initially. Initially, people were excited to have a national platform. But it was after this misconstrual happened over and over again that people started to become really, really skeptical of major media. So I think as someone who didn't come with a set of press credentials, and as someone who, you know, was very transparent about my background, I was very transparent about the fact that regardless of what the facts are, an unarmed teenager is killed, and that's wrong. It has to be wrong. That has to be the starting point of the conversation, whatever the course of action after that is. And so I think that kind of opened some doors. I found that people were welcoming to a degree, and then, like you were saying, coming back time and time again after the clear, you know, media frenzy had ended, we were still there and still committed. And I think people just recognized that consistency, and it allowed us to build genuine trust with people.
You introduce the viewers to some really interesting people, some great characters. How did you go about choosing who to focus on?
We kind of started by talking to whoever would speak to us, and whoever seemed to have something different and special that they were contributing. I think all of the people who you see in the film are people who, in one way or another, are connectors in their and in their communities and people who inspire others. And all had different tactics, different points of views, different strengths. And we wanted to demonstrate that even within the context of one movement, even within the context of Black people, there's no one monolithic perspective. There's no one monolithic point of view. You know, the idea that our lives matter, we share, and I think that's something that everyone should be able to agree on, but how to achieve that in reality, how to make that feel true. People disagree on the ways to approach that, and that disagreement can exist, it can coexist. And so that's a message that we wanted to put to everyone. I think we all need to understand a little bit better the fact that we don't have to think the same way or have the same tactics. If we can share some fundamental values, we can work in our own lanes, our own time frames, with our own small groups, and still get things done. So that was kind of the rationale. And then over time, we followed 7 people in depth. All of them appear in the film in some level or another. But over time, just what the story needed started to determine who would actually show up. And we did take time to speak with the police. We took time to speak with the mayor. And we just found that those interviews did not have the same human quality as the other interviews we were doing. We found that we were getting talking points and things that you could see if you turned on CNN. So it didn't make it into the film. And those were tough decisions to make because we knew we opened ourselves up to criticism about being unbalanced. But we set out to tell a story from the perspective of being on the ground in that situation. And, you know, that I think in staying true to that, we ended up with the format that we have.
You use a lot of crowdsource video that people were actually shooting in the moment, mm-hmm. on the various nights. How did you go through that? How did you choose? Because there must have been so much.
I don't know how many hours, but over 30 archival sources ended up in the film. We figured, you know, this is something that was so well documented, it'll be easy to find the archives. And we found ourselves just facing this huge, mass amount of information. And so I just really have to commend my team for being able to weave through that and find what was really important, and you know, to Chris for being able to create a continuous space out of these really disparate pieces of footage. I think it's something that I don't know that I've seen done in documentary with that many sources, you know, so close to the proximity of an event. So I just really admire his creativity and the way he was able to do that.
Talking today to Sabah Folayan, the director of Whose Streets. It's a documentary opening nationally this weekend. It's about the protests following the death of Michael Brown Jr. in Ferguson, Missouri, 3 years ago. You follow this very specific set of incidents, but of course there were several happening all over the country, including what happened here with Philando Castile.
Yeah.
Do you see connections coming out of what happened in Ferguson in terms of the tactics and the community response?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, though this is a movement that is largely made up and led by millennials, but I don't think people really understand the extent to which we are influenced by the civil rights movement, by leaders of the past, by people like, you know, Ella Baker and Dr. King and Medgar Evers and all these people who have laid a lot of groundwork, and then the people that we still have in our communities, you know, in the film, Jamala Rogers, Montega Simmons, people who have been doing this work for a really, really long time are our mentors and our teachers. And so in that way, yes, you're going to see certain similarities in tactics. And also, you know, we have the benefit of social media. We have the benefit of this tool that allows us to communicate. And so ideas can spread a lot more rapidly, I think, than they could at another time. And so in that way, a lot of communication and shared tactics were able to come about. And I think the third thing is really intentionally, you know, with the event of Ferguson October, organizers in St. Louis decided that this was going to become a national movement. They decided to create this space and put out this national, it was a national call to action. They asked people to take a pledge that they were going to participate in this from wherever they were with whatever tools that they had. So some very intentional organizing on behalf of people in St. Louis that I think facilitated some of this shared ideology that you see around the country.
There's a very striking scene in the film of a blocking of the freeway, which happened here a couple of times and really freaked people out. I caused a level of consternation, which I don't think I've ever seen, at least in this community. And it was partly because of the inherent danger of doing something like that, but also the people who were just incensed because they had been inconvenienced. But again, it all seemed to be fairly spontaneous, the way that things developed. There's the spontaneity there, which seems to a certain extent have been happening in Ferguson, but also some careful planning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it is a combination of that. I think that, you know, any organizer who is able to pull off shutting down a freeway and no one being harmed, it's not going to be a super spontaneous action. It's something that does take a great deal of logistical planning to do safely. And I don't think people fully take into account how much organizers and activists do think about and try to control those circumstances and keep people safe if they have chosen nonviolent resistance as their tactic. A lot of times, you know, it falls apart. There are so many factors outside of your control. Once the police get there and they start gassing and spraying and, you know, people start running and it gets chaotic. But there is a lot of really intentional work that goes into trying to pull these actions off in a way that is legible to people from the outside and really sends a message. I think the highway shutdowns are something that, you know, it's tough because you don't get to control who's affected, who's stuck in traffic. You don't get to say who, you know, this side or that side. But I think it's important in that way symbolically because it's one of the few actions I think that we have left that says how urgent things are, you know, how serious this really is, and trying to elevate a life or death situation to the level of life or death in people's minds, because it's become this kind of drone in the background. Yeah, we know black people get killed by police, but black on black crime, they kill each other. They don't like being alive that much, so why should I care? And so trying to bring this back to the level of, no, this is an emergency. We have a society where our police are executing people in the street in broad daylight, no due process, no oversight. And if it's us today, it could be anybody tomorrow. And we really, I think organizers really just were trying to shake people and get people's attention. You polarize people in multiple directions. That's the thing about activism, is you don't get to choose which direction people get polarized in. You just shake it up. And, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see the fallout of this, you know, in the years and months to come. But one thing is for sure is that we're not going to be able to change this country by asking for it. It's not going to be handed down from above. It never has. Freedom never has been handed down to the people from the powerful. And it's going to take some discomfort. It's going to take some disruption. It's going to take business as usual being stopped. I think people are much more open to that now that we see Donald Trump and we see real fascism starting to encroach into our precious, perfect democracy.
Where, I mean, you had to say, okay, at some point, we're done. We have to complete this film, but the story's not over. Where do you go with the story from now, other than to a lot of film festivals?
This is something that I'm learning. This is my first film, and so I'm excited to be working with Magnolia. I'm excited that it's going to be seen in theaters nationally. I think the experience of watching the film together in a room with others is really important. It's made to be consumed as part of a community. And I genuinely believe that the ripple effects will be tangible. I believe that people are going to become activated by it. I believe that they're going to be motivated to take tangible and specific actions in their own local communities. And that's what my hope is. And I just want to bring it to the places and people who are most poised to do that, to communities of color, people who need to be emboldened and empowered and reminded that what matters to them is important, reminded that what's happening to them is real, and that they have the power when they come together with others to make a difference. And it may be a small difference, it may be a long-term difference, but, you know, this country has been changed. People will talk about Black Lives Matter for the rest of the history of this country, and we have drawn a line in the sand that people will have to respond to in one way or another, and who knows if or when we'll arrive at the world that we really, really want, but it's important to always be pushing toward that. I think people, a lot of times people say, you know, it's always been this way. And they'll either say it's always been this way or it could be worse. And I'm reminded of a book that Amy Goodman wrote called The Silenced Majority, that's about the history of movement building in this country. And I don't think that we factor in the ways in which these acts of resistance are the reason why it's not worse. And I think that people who say it's always been this way are not participating in the real material day-to-day reality of the world when they say that. Because sure, maybe by and large it's always been this way. Maybe the, you know, general outline of things is the same. But there are really tangible ways in which policy decisions matter, in which protest matters, in which local elections can be swayed and people can be forced to resign and, you know, resources can be reallocated. And I think people need to re-engage a little bit with what's right in their own backyard. I think with this a globalized world and the amount of media that's out there, it's easy to feel like we're all thinking about what's going on all over the world, and it's way too big and too much for us to change. And I think that I hope that the film refocuses people on trying to be active agents and participating in what they can control and what they can put their hands on and what they can conceive and what they can do with the people who live on their block and their neighborhood and their district. That's my biggest hope for the movie.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Sabah Folayan is the director of Whose Streets, a documentary about the protests and long-term organizing in Ferguson, Missouri, following the death of Michael Brown Jr. The film is opening nationwide this weekend.